Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It was embarrassing. I thought that was embarrassing.
And the dogs are tied to people who are on skis.
It's graffiti, I guess, but with knit fabric.
It's easy to understand it in your head. It's a different thing to try to bring it to your dinner table and explain it to your family and go, this is something I'm really keen on.
This week on Culture Q, Death in the Twin Cities.
From the studios of KUOM Radio K, this is Culture Q, the arts show that rocks. Tickets are free, and there's no wait, so take a seat and hold on to your radio.
Hello, and welcome to Culture Q. I'm Eric Dolsky, filling in for Sarah Bowden. Today is another one of our summer theme shows, the topic, Death in the Twin Cities. We start the show off with the death of something traditionally given life only in Stephen King novels, the common building. How do you differentiate between a historic marker and a deadly eyesore? Who is the executioner of the everyday structure? Brady Nias gets an explanation with this report.
In pursuit of progress, more than just a slogan, North American Dismantling Corporation is leading the way into the future with expert demolition services, helping to clear away the past by providing a clean slate for reclamation and new construction projects throughout North America since 1984.
Whether it's an old Vegas casino imploding on TV, or the careful deconstruction of the music education building right here on campus, death is everywhere you look.
You know, I think it is something that we can grieve for in a community, so to speak, because these are really the vessels of our memories. They're the places where our lives have happened.
I spoke with Bonnie McDonald, executive director of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, by Bluetooth headset. She was on her way to another meeting. McDonald's whole staff stays busy, as they're devoted to preserving, or at least adaptively reusing, historic buildings in and around Minnesota. Others argue, what good are a bunch of old buildings? Is it fair to treat them as people?
Some of this old stuff needs to come down for the new renaissance to come in.
Tim Seagraves works at North American Dismantling Corporation. Its business is destruction. Thanks to Seagraves and Company, I can inhale that comforting smell of LEED-certified infrastructure in more places. It's one of my favorite scents.
I think at one time the demolition business used to be kind of looked at as, you know, just kind of like maybe scrap people or gypsies, but it is real science and art now, and that's what, you know, I guess that's what we kind of bring to the table. It's really kind of a niche business, and there's certainly a need for it with the changing of America.
While Seagraves says our love of old buildings may be hazardous to our health, our economy, even to our environment, McDonald and her crew believe in total reuse.
Look first at reuse because, number one, we're reinvesting in those resources, those raw materials that have already been expended from the environment. But two, we have to re-extract materials to build the new building.
Over in demolition land.
The big push now is to have, you know, the majority of it, if not all, recycled.
I don't like 70s-era buildings, though they are old and perhaps historic. I can't fathom why we preserve them.
The continuum is that history is being made every day. And these 1970s utilitarian buildings may not be attractive to, you know, to a certain person today, but in another generation, they're going to appreciate them. So our job is to be stewards of our resources. There's going to be a group of people who are going to want to save properties that are being built today in another 60 and 70 years.
Turns out we did that once already in our nation's history. The program was called Urban Renewal.
A large-scale clearance of downtown areas.
And it was met with mixed reviews. Now every home or commercial property in Minneapolis is monitored by the Heritage Preservation Commission. The commission rescues old buildings and sites from progress, which we've learned is absolutely in the eye of the beholder. And if buildings really are like people, the only thing constant is change. For Culture Q, I'm Brady Nias.
Thank you.
The picturesque Fort Snelling is the site of the largest mass execution in the history of the United States. Joe Crawl walks the fort's grounds to find out why it happened.
In the shadow of the Mendota Bridge, below Fort Snelling, stands a memorial commemorating Minnesota's greatest shame, the concentration camp that occupied these grounds following the Dakota War of 1862. Underneath a canopy of hardwoods, it remembers the people, mostly women and children, who were interred here. As Kevin Myla of the Minnesota Historical Society and I walk the fort grounds, his story reveals the legacy of imperialism mortared between the very bricks of the fort.
You have to understand that the Dakota were really under a lot of pressure in this particular period. Their land had really been given up, and through these treaties with the United States from 1851, the four main Dakota bands that lived here were living in a very small tract of land that was only 10 miles wide by this time on the southern side of the Minnesota River. There was severe drought, so there was a lot of hunger, some starvation. And the United States, frankly, was not living up to its treaty obligations through the 1851 treaty. The annuity payments were late on an annual basis, and these payments were important because the Dakota were relying on those for buying food and buying goods that would allow them to live on the reservation. In addition, the United States policy was essentially to try to break down traditional Dakota culture. The conflict itself is really started by a very small number of Dakota. The vast majority did not participate in the fighting, as far as we can tell, and really were innocent of any sort of action against the United States in this period.
Following 6 weeks of fighting from August 17, 1862 until September 26, 1862, about 1,600 Dakota men, women, and children were force-marched the roughly 130 miles from Upper Sioux to the fort, where a concentration camp was established to contain them over the winter of 1862-1863.
When you look at the accounts of the period from the newspapers and from personal accounts and from oral history from the Dakota, which we've had a chance to talk to a lot of Dakota about, it was a horrific place. We know that at least 130 died, most of them from measles, which was running rampant through the state and through the United States military at this time as well. But we also know from accounts, oral history as well as written accounts, that there were attacks on the Dakota, that several were killed either by soldiers or people who had come into the camp. We know that there were sexual assaults. To Dakota tradition, this is also the genesis, the origins of their people here at the junction of these two rivers. So it's a sacred place in that aspect as well, which is another important aspect, obviously, of the interpretation here.
Jim Anderson of the Mendota Dakota probably best characterized the camp when he stated, "This is the site of our genesis and also our genocide." During this time, a military tribunal convicted over 300 Dakota of murder and sexual assault charges stemming from the war in a series of trials lasting mere minutes and conducted exclusively in English. President Lincoln revoked the convictions of all but 38 men who were hung the day after Christmas, 1862, in Mankato, in what remains the largest mass execution in U.S. history. The following spring of 1863, Dakota people were formally banished from the state of Minnesota, and the remainder of their lands appropriated by the United States government. For Culture Q, I'm Joe Crawl.
The art of Filipino stick fighting, otherwise known as eskrima, is one of the more refined ways of letting loose the beatdown in a controlled environment. Katie Dyson chats up one of the U's eskrima experts, a girl who also happens to be a world champion in her division.
A slim frame, strawberry blonde locks, and steel blue eyes hide a deadly secret. My friend Jenna Latewine is an eskrima world champion several times over. She competes for Four Winds Martial Arts in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But a twist of fate introduced Jenna to Filipino martial arts.
We won this month-long membership to a place called Four Winds Martial Arts that turned out to be just a couple blocks from my house, which I had never known about. And it all started there, I guess.
Eskrima, also known as Kali or Arnis, is a traditional Filipino martial arts form passed down orally. For centuries, it was hidden from various colonial governments and instead practiced clandestinely by local populations who disguised eskrima as formal dances or stick-based techniques. Here in the United States, the art grew in popularity after the Philippine-American War. Today, eskrima can be seen in popular films such as The Book of Eli, the Jason Bourne series, and 300, and is also taught to special forces units within the United States military. Jenna practices eskrima as a sport, traveling around the globe for World Eskrima Kali Arnis Federation competitions. Similar to a boxing match, competitors fight in short rounds, scoring points for various hits and attacks.
Like on a point system, very similar to a boxing match, based on cumulative total damage to a person's body. 1 minute rounds, standard. That's standard for most adults. The children's divisions, I believe, it's 45 seconds per round with a 30-second break. For adults, it's a minute with 30-second breaks. No one actually ever gets knocked out, unless barring horrible accidents. And you need to have offense and defense in these matches.
Jenna competes with heavy padding, helmets, and blunted sticks, but still ends up sore and bruised after a good bout.
As the art has evolved into a sport, we have padded tunics we wear. We wear special gloves. When I first started, I had hockey gloves. They work fine, but the eskrima gloves we have are a little more mitten-like. They protect all your fingers together. And then in addition to that, we wear thigh pads. Some people wear knee pads, which is generally a good idea. You're not supposed to hit below the thigh, but things happen. I've been smacked in the knee unprotected, and it's not fun. We have headgear, special headgear. It's a padded helmet with a metal face mask. It makes a great sound when you hit it, so people aim for that in tournaments because it's something that everyone can hear really loudly, gets the judges' attention.
There is also an artistic part of official competition. Forms require competitors to perform a routine of moves, often set to music.
Unlike fighting, it's a floor routine that you do, and you can do them traditionally. There's traditional and non traditional forms. So non traditional, you can have music, you can have costumes, you can have high flying kicks. They take a lot of time to do. I'm a perfectionist, and I get kind of nervous in front of crowds. If you're in a fight, you get the adrenaline dump and you just go and you don't see anyone else except for your opponent. But in a form, it's a performance and you're really doing it for everyone around you. And then you stand there and get judged at the end. So
during a recent trip to the Philippines, Jenna purchased the traditional and more deadly handmade sticks, knives, and swords used by eskrimadors.
Different etchings, or they can be very, very fancy or very plain. Both sticks can hurt people. So, I have a couple of swords of my own. There's training swords, and then real ones that I got in the Philippines. There was a whole shop that was just chock full of more swords and sticks than I'd seen in my life, and so that was very fun. Getting everything through security was a little nerve-wracking, but as long as you check your bags, we sent them through, and then customs was like, oh, Arnis,
Jenna's expert skills are largely confined to the ring. But her deadly speed and iron composure translate easily to real-world situations. A strict, unwritten code of honor restrains Jenna to the ring, but the skills and values learned in eskrima give her a surreptitious confidence. This month, in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, Jenna will be defending her title as WECAF World Champion. Reporting for Culture Q, I'm Katie Dyson.
They say that when one person dies, it's a tragedy, and when 1,000 people die, it's a statistic. And when 6.8 billion die, I imagine nobody's saying much of anything. With that in mind, Josh Ellis and University of Minnesota astronomy professor Lawrence Rudnick discuss 7 chilling scenarios of cosmic destruction.
The one that everybody knows about is asteroids coming and smashing into the Earth. And we have thousands of tons of material that are constantly landing on the Earth all the time. Most of them are dust-sized particles, and they just break up in the atmosphere, and we see them as shooting stars. If they're a little bit bigger, they make it down to Earth, and we call them meteorites. We can collect them on the ground. And if they're really big, then they'll make craters and can actually cause some damage. And so the last really big one was in the near the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and wiped out the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago. And we're certainly going to get hit again. There's nothing nearby. We actually know that now because our telescopes are good enough that we can check it out. There certainly could be things big enough to do significant damage, wipe out a city, wipe out Minneapolis. But we don't see any right now, and so not to worry about in our lifetimes, but it's going to happen again.
Are you a Deep Impact or Armageddon fan?
Oh, man. Armageddon is pretty good, but both of them, they're all fun.
What are some other events?
Well, another one that's really kind of subtle and most people don't talk about is that we could be ejected from our solar system if another star came by close to us, which, it's not going to happen, but it does happen other places in our galaxy. If a star came very by, it could basically steal the planets from our sun. It could eject them and go off into wild orbits. And then we would die it'd be an interesting question about how quickly would we die. We wouldn't have the sun anymore. So it would be matters of probably days or weeks when we finally got far enough from the sun and we lost all the energy and things started dying off. So that one's not going to happen, but it's another fun one to think about.
You say we would die without the sun. Is there a way the sun could be a cause for catastrophe for us on Earth?
Yeah, there's the sun already does affect us on Earth in fairly substantial ways. And we're more concerned about that now because with all the spacecraft that we have, there are very high energy flares that come from the sun, and they certainly endanger astronauts that are out in space. They do affect our atmosphere. They give us, they help trigger things like the auroral displays that we see that are nice. But the one thing that is certain to happen is 4.5 billion years from now, the sun's going to burn out and it's going to be done. And at that point, it will restructure itself and swell up enormously for a very short period of time, sort of as it begins its death throes. And we're going to find ourselves inside, right at the edge of the atmosphere of the sun. So everything on the surface of the Earth is just going to be incinerated. So if you really want something to worry about 4.5 billion years from now, that's going to happen.
Gamma ray bursts.
Sure.
What is that? What is a gamma ray in the first place?
Well, a gamma ray is a very high energy photon, so it's just like the light that we see. And if they go through you, then they can certainly cause a lot of damage. And so there are objects in the sky that when they explode, they're related to supernova explosions, but when they explode, they give off very intense sources of gamma rays. And if we were near enough to one and in the path where the gamma rays were coming off, it certainly could evaporate our atmosphere off, could cook us basically, like being in a microwave oven. The atmosphere would be gone, we'd all be cooked. We see these very energetic events all throughout the universe. One would have to be within about 3,000 light years in order to get us. And we've looked around in the nearby 3,000 light years or so, and it doesn't look like there's any things that are going to go off and explode as gamma ray bursts. But it's another thing in what could get us. How about being swallowed by a black hole? That's pretty good.
I'll say.
Right? And it's great science fiction stuff. And people, even most recently, were worried about the high energy accelerator in CERN. And whether or not it was going to create mini black holes that would then start passing through the Earth and sucking up pieces of the Earth and eventually wiping us out. So again, it's a theoretical possibility. The chances of it happening are quite slim. Again, not worth losing sleep over. But if a black hole with about a mass of the sun, about the same mass as the sun, were to come by in our solar system, it certainly could start swallowing things up that were in its path. It would probably do damage like another star, disrupting the orbits of the planets. But it has the extra capability of anything that encounters would fall into it, never to reappear.
Okay, two to go.
Two to go.
What's one more catastrophic event for our planet?
some people worry a lot about the work that we're doing in terms of searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. And in fact, Stephen Hawking just came out with an idea that was actually fairly old, but he reiterated it again, and said we shouldn't be seeking to make contact with any kind of extraterrestrial beings because, and there's a statistical argument that you can make, that's a good statistical argument that says they are much more likely to be very advanced, way ahead of us in terms of their technology, and we may be of no importance to them at all, sort of like we would discover some ants and we would not worry about whether or not we were going to harm the ant colonies that we found on another planet. And so invasion by aliens or making contact by aliens.
One more. What's the last way that we could end up, or not the last way, but one more way, one final way that we might meet our fate?
Well, the last one that I thought would be fun to talk about is the fact that the universe itself at some point will die is a strange word, but it will end. It will end being some place where we could live. Stars typically live for billions of years. New generations of stars are born, but eventually you use up all the material that could form new stars, and then when the last stars wink out, we're gone. And so people talk about the universe being sort of a cold, dark place in the end. We're probably talking about many hundreds or thousands of billions of years in the future, far away, but the universe as we know it will almost certainly end.
From science to science fiction, this week Culture Q asks, Alien versus Predator, who would you rather take on before your inevitable and horrific death?
It's tricky because the aliens have got the strength in numbers, so if it was just one alien, then of course you'd rather face that because that'd be easier to deal with. The three predators, however, I don't know, man.
I'd fight an alien because they're just bugs that shoot acid, and they have no forethought in their actions.
A predator. Aliens are huge. Aliens are massive.
Those green things coming out of my mouth, I couldn't handle them.
A predator. Aliens will kick the shit out of you. They've got another mouth within another mouth that will just stab at you. With a predator, they just rip your spine out like they did in that movie.
I don't know, I pretty much watch all the Aliens and Predator movies. Yeah, aliens are deadly, but they aren't very smart, so...
Well, it depends on where I am, I would suppose.
I'd want to face off against the Predators in South America, because at least that way I'd have the home turf advantage. You know what I'm saying?
And if I did get out, I'd have a place to go, like Argentina or somewhere.
And I think the face-grabbing thing would be a cool way to go.
So when scientists like find my body, they'll just be puzzled.
The final story of today's show is by me, and I like to think that it encompasses the senselessness of human existence. Enjoy. This is the part of the story where I use hopelessly gauche and outdated Pac-Man sound effects to indicate that this story is about video games. Pac-Man is an early, almost prehistoric representation of what games, video games, have become today. Role-playing game commentator Dan Repperger of FearTheBoot.com puts it best.
You are going to take on the role of someone else. You are going to pretend to be someone else, somewhere else, doing something other than what you are really doing.
In Pac-Man, you take on the role of the yellow ball, or Mrs. Yellow Ball, in what I guess is some labyrinth of eternal night. You consume dots and fruit until the multicolored ghosts of the labyrinth take their unholy revenge upon you. And if you never quite got Pac-Man, that game of pretending to be an insatiable yellow ball in permanent flight from ghosts, Dan Repperger says to think of an actor.
When they get up on stage, whether it's for a movie or for a play, for a little bit of time, they are pretending to be someone else.
Whether it's the Wii or the Xbox 360 or the PC or the PS Triple, games have changed. Not in their outcome, but in their methods of producing entertainment. And this is where we come to Progress Quest, the logical end of gaming. In Progress Quest, there's no need for skill or competence or playing at all. All you need to do is double-click the desktop icon and let your PC do what it does best. Complete progress bar after progress bar after progress bar. West Coast software developer Eric Fredrickson created Progress Quest, which now consumes the system resources of hundreds of thousands of users since it was created 9 years ago.
I probably, in two evenings, put it together. You know, I ran it by a few friends, and they gave me some suggestions. My brother corrected some spelling.
The premise of Progress Quest is based on a typical role-playing game, say World of Warcraft or EverQuest or Final Fantasy or some other title with disturbing parallels to modern capitalism.
You know, I played some, I think, Knights of Camelot, and I just found one day that I was going to this field and just slaughtering these spectral hogs. It was just this area where there were spectral hogs everywhere. I would just, you know, walk up to them and slaughter them. I started to feel like, you know, there's a computer sitting there that knows perfectly well. It's such a simple algorithm to slaughter spectral hog after spectral hog.
But to make Progress Quest completely self-playing, you can't have a bunch of actions that constantly need performing all the time. Fredrickson's solution was to replace human input with progress bars.
Progress Quest is inspired by RPGs and by installing Windows. And when you watch the progress bars in Windows, you're probably kind of frustrated, but those progress bars kind of, like, you want to see them go up, and you get some kind of thrill when they go up, you know. And I think that, you know, both when you're installing Windows or playing a game, there's some kind of endorphin rush when things increase and your character gets a bit more power.
So now the game is well underway. Thousands of progress bars have been filled, and I've already acquired my +8 Cambric Titanium Greaves along with my +4 polished Vorpal Bandyclef. So why do I still want to play the game? I'll admit I don't actively want to play, but unlike with most role-playing games, I'm not developing a crippling knot in my stomach that's telling me to quit the game cold turkey. Why is that?
I guess it's, you know, sort of people's drive to succeed, you know, and to sort of accomplish things, but, you know, it's basically perverting the natural instinct of people to accomplish things. But, you know, role-playing games are kind of the same thing. They're not real accomplishments, but they feel like it. I guess that pleases people. Whether it should, I don't know, but it kind of does.
Progress Quest is a postmodern game. Like life, it's senseless, brutish, and full of entertaining flashes within a generally mediocre experience. I get stuff that doesn't really mean anything to get more stuff that doesn't really mean anything. And to get these things, I slaughter everyone in my path. That's the joke. For Radio K's Culture Q, I'm Eric Dolsky. Well, that is our show for this week. You can hear this broadcast and previous broadcasts of Culture Q at RadioK.org's programming page. Today you heard stories from Brady Nias, Joe Krall, Katie Dyson, Josh Ellis, Kevin Carner, and me, Eric Dolsky. Our producers are Sarah Bowden, Christetta Barini, Brady Nias, and Zach McCormick. I'm Eric Dolsky. Until next time, this is Culture Q.